Thanks very much for inviting me. All right. So today I'm going to talk to you about the renormalization of entanglement entropy and the gravitational effect of action. This is work in collaboration with Marcus Luddy, also at Davis, and it's based on this preprint that came out just on Monday. So I'm going to start off with some very familiar material, but I'm going to try to put it in a slightly different light. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about black hole thermodynamics and entanglement entropy. All right, so the classical laws of black hole mechanics, right, suggest that the horizon surface gravity, kappa, right, is in some sense analogous to a temperature for the black hole, and that the area of the black hole horizon, A, right, is in some sense analogous to, right, an entropy for the black hole. So people were wondering, right, is this analogy, is it more than an analogy, right? Do black holes really have thermodynamic properties? So people looked at the physics of quantum fields propagating on black hole spacetimes, right, and Hawking in particular, right, found that indeed, right, when there are these quantum fields propagating on the spacetime, the black hole appears to have a temperature, right, given by kappa over 2 pi, and it appears to have an entropy given by, right, a quarter of the area in Planck units. All right. So the thing that I want to note, right, this is all familiar material, but right, really, right, the thermodynamics of black holes were established by not just looking at the black holes, but by looking at these quantum fields interacting with them. So you might wonder sort of to what extent these quantities are sort of properties of the fields as opposed to properties of the black hole. Okay. So in particular, the entropy, there's a very natural entropy to associate with the quantum fields propagating on the black hole. Right? If you're an observer outside the black hole, you don't have access to anything within the horizon of the black hole. So you could ask about what the entanglement entropy is of the quantum fields outside of the black hole, right? So there's some reduced density matrix that describes the fields outside of the black hole, and you can just ask, well, what's the von Neumann entropy of that density matrix? Okay. So some people started thinking about this in the early 1980s. And what they found was that if you look at the reduced density matrix of the quantum fields outside of the horizon of the black hole, and you compute the von Neumann entropy, the leading term, well, it's UV divergent, but it's proportional to the area of the horizon. Okay, right. And in particular, right, you might want to set your cutoff at the Planck length, right? And then you would indeed get a contribution from this entanglement entropy of the right order to explain that entropy. So in that sense, it might seem quite natural to guess that this black hole entropy is actually just the entanglement entropy of the quantum fields. So then, slightly later, Susskind and Noglum put forth a conjecture for how to understand the fact that the entanglement entropy is divergent. And what they said, or what they conjectured, is that this UV divergence, maybe we can just absorb that UV divergence of the entanglement entropy into a renormalization of the Planck mass. That was their idea. All right. So at about the same time, Kalin and Wilczek were thinking about how to compute the entanglement entropy in a quantum field theory. Right. So the entanglement entropy is defined if you give me a quantum state on some time slice sigma, and you give me some codimension 2 entangling surface omega on sigma, right? Then I can compute the reduced, right, the reduced state on one side of this entangling surface, and I can compute the entanglement entropy for that reduced state. Right. So Kalin and Wilczek said that you could compute that entanglement entropy in the following way. So they gave this formula. So here, right, WE super delta. This is the gravitational effective action that you get by integrating out whatever fields you have propagating on your space-time. But it's the gravitational effect of action where you've inserted a conical singularity of deficit angle delta on the entangling surface omega. All right, so they say compute that object, take this particular derivative operator of it, and then take the limit as delta goes to zero, and that should give you the entanglement entropy. All right. So I want to note two things about this formula. So the first thing to note is that, at least as it's given in this form, the Kalin-Wilczek formula requires that the space-time that you're thinking about must have a rotational symmetry about the entangling surface. We're thinking in Euclidean signature. Okay. And the way to see that, I think, is as follows. So let's suppose that this is sort of the plane in which we're going to introduce our conical singularity. If we didn't have a rotational symmetry about the entangling surface in this plane, you would have to say something further in order to make a prescription for how to compute this entanglement entropy, If there was some feature such that there weren't a rotational symmetry, you'd have to say, well, where do I insert the conical singularity? Sort of where do I cut out this wedge, And if you don't tell me that, I don't know how to do that. So the only case I can treat it for is if I have rotational symmetry.
Just one U1?
You probably need more. I'm gonna talk about what more you might need. And you'll see how this rotational symmetry will come back to really help us out. So the other thing to note is that, in general, the gravitational effect of action is UV divergent. So this basically tells you that the UV divergences in the gravitational effect of action are going to give rise to UV divergences in the entanglement entropy. Okay. So all the material I just talked about is kind of old by now. So you might be wondering, what am I going to add, or what am I going to talk about? So there's sort of two things that I'm going to talk about. So on the one hand, I'm going to ask the question, under what conditions can the Kalin-Wilczek formula be rigorously justified? So in our paper and in this talk, we give a set of sufficient conditions. They're certainly not, we don't think they're necessary, for which the Kalin-Wilczek formula is rigorously justified. So there are basically these four conditions. So I should, first of all, say we really think that the Kalin-Wilczek formula is justified more generally than these. But these are the conditions under which we can give a derivation of the Kalin-Wilczek formula. So first of all, we have to treat only quantum field theories that don't allow for quantum fluctuations of gravity, so no gravitons. We can only look at space-times that have a bifurcate Killing horizon. That's basically the analog in Lorentzian signature of that rotation symmetry. And that also tells us that the entangling surface cannot have extrinsic curvature. And then we can only, so far, have been able to derive the Kalin-Wilczek formula for a certain class of quantum states, which we can write down using a Euclidean path integral. Yeah?
Couldn't you have fluctuations of gravitons that, without those being coupled, just the free gravitons, why can't those contribute like any other field?
So I'll get to that.
There's a specific problem.
Yeah, so there is a specific problem, I think, even if the only fields you have are gravitons. So we're going to end up doing a regularization of this conical singularity. And so far, we haven't found any way to regulate it in a consistent manner when there are gravitons present. That's the basic point.
All right.
Right. So in a sense, right, you can consider each of these sort of a challenge, right? Right. We certainly believe that the Kalinowicz-like formula is true more generally, but there are challenges in trying to lift each of these conditions. All right. So I should note one other thing. If you're familiar with the literature, you'll know that the Kalin-Wilczek formula is often justified via what's called the replica trick, where you take a power, an integer power of the reduced density matrix, and you analytically continue in that power to get the entangled entropy. So it might be that that analytic continuation is justified, but I don't know of anywhere in the literature where it's rigorously justified. So we're not going to appeal to the replica trick. We're going to give a direct derivation under these conditions. All right. Okay. So then on the other hand, this talk is about, once we've established the Kalin-Wilczek formula as computing the entanglement entropy, what does it tell us about the entanglement entropy? And the basic message is that it tells us the following, that the Susskind-Dugalum conjecture holds for all leading and subleading UV divergent terms in the entanglement entropy to all orders in perturbation theory. All right, so let me just briefly tell you what quantitative results we've been able to show. All right, so this is what we can say about the entanglement entropy associated with an entangling surface in a quantum field theory with those conditions that I showed in the last slide. All right. So if you give me some UV divergent term F in the gravitational effective action, I can compute the contribution to the entanglement entropy from that term. So I have some UV cutoff, lambda, and the contribution is given by negative 2 pi. This is just the coefficient of the term F in the effective action that you would get by integrating out the fields, whatever they are, to whatever order in the loop expansion you feel like computing to. Right, then you have the divergence associated with the mass dimension of that operator. And then you just have an integral over the entangling surface of a particular geometrical invariant, which we call I1. And it's constructed by a particular algorithm that we give just from F, just from the invariant F. Okay. All right. So we have this UV divergent gravitational effective action. Right. We could add to it a counter term for the term F. Right. We could add F naught, and we could get a renormalized gravitational effective action. Right. Well, then we get a renormalized entanglement entropy that's finite. And it's just right this divergent piece plus the piece coming from the counter term. so this is finite, right? The way we interpret the divergent piece is just the usual way you would interpret the divergent piece when you're doing effective field theory, right? This is just parameterizing via the cutoff the contributions for modes above whatever cutoff you've set. So let me just note two particular consequences of these results. Okay. So if we want to look at the leading UV divergent contribution to the, or the leading contribution to the entanglement entropy, that comes from the Einstein-Hilbert term, where the invariant F is just the Ricci scalar R. So if we can compute using this prescription the UV divergent piece contribution to the entanglement entropy, and it's just proportional to the area of the entangling surface. If we add the counter term, we get a contribution that's just a quarter of the bare Planck mass to the d minus 2 times the area. And these add together in just the right way to give us the renormalized entanglement entropy as basically the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, right? One quarter the renormalized Planck mass to the d minus 2 times the area of the entangling surface. Where did this come from? So this is, we've added a counter term, so something like this, to the gravitational effective action. So a counter term for the Ricci scalar. That's right.
then that gives a term of force for the area of entropy?
Right. So if I'll show this in slightly more detail later, but so if you take this UV, if you take this geometric invariant F to be the Ricci scalar, when you compute this geometric invariant I, it turns out to be equal to 2. So this is just 2. You get an integral over the entangling surface, which gives you the area. And this factor of 2 is just precisely right, so that when you add this and this together, the areas factor out, and what you're left with is precisely what you would call the renormalized Planck mass.
So you're doing that for F equals?
The Ricci scalar. The Einstein-Hilbert.
Which has
two.
So why isn't there one there? Oh, I see.
Yeah. So
that's that term.
So this is the.
Okay.
Yeah, this is this term.
And the first term? The second term?
The second term is the term you get for the counter term from the Ricci scalar. So it's this term evaluated for.
Scalar gives you the area.
How?
You're saying it's the same.
Yeah, so we're just, right, we're just renormalizing the coefficient of the Ricci scalar here. We're just adding the counter term that would renormalize the coefficient of the Ricci scalar. Is that right? I mean, in this particular example. All right. So you can also look at the contributions to the entanglement entropy coming from subleading UV divergent terms. And the interesting thing that we find there is that, in general, these subleading contributions depend explicitly on what quantum state you're in. So the leading contribution only depended on the area, so it appears to be state independent. But these subleading contributions appear not to be, and that seems not to have been really appreciated in the literature so far. All right. Okay, so in the rest of the talk, I'm going to give you an outline of how we do these computations of the entanglement entropy. Right? So I'll define a little more precisely the entanglement entropy. I'll tell you about what class of states we can compute things for. And then I'll derive the Kalin-Wilczek formula for that class of states. And then I'll calculate the entanglement entropy from the Kalin-Wilczek formula. All right. Then I'll tell you how our results fit in with the literature, how they compare to the Wald entropy. And then I'll conclude with some open questions. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about entanglement entropy in quantum field theory. All right, so let's just consider some quantum field phi propagating on some fixed background space-time. All right, so this is the geometry that we're considering. So first of all, we pick some time slice sigma. And then we're just going to let the field, capital phi, we're going to denote the field on the time slice by lowercase phi. Then we're going to pick some entangling surface, omega, that divides the time surface, sigma, into two parts, sigma A and sigma B. And we'll just call the fields, phi A and phi B, restricted to the two sides of the entangling surface. Okay, so let's assume we have some, for the pure quantum state of the fields, defined on the time slice sigma. And we're going to use the field operator basis, right? So we can write the density matrix for the corresponding to the state on the time slice sigma just in that basis, just right in that fashion as usual. All right. So to compute the entanglement entropy, what we really need is the reduced quantum state on one side of the entangling surface. Right? So let's just choose side A of the entangling surface. Right? So the reduced density matrix on that side is just, we get that by tracing over the degrees of freedom on side B. Okay? Right? So if we trace over the degrees of freedom on side B, right, we can just do a path integral over the fields on side B, right, tracing, so we set phi B prime equal to phi B. And that at least formally gives us the reduced density matrix in this basis for side A. To compute the entanglement entropy, right, we're just computing the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density matrix, negative the trace of rho log rho. Right? Or we can think about it as the expectation value of the log of rho, if we want. All right. So again, at least formally, right, we can write down the entanglement entropy just by doing a path integral now over the field degrees of freedom on side A of the reduced density matrix log the reduced density matrix. All right. Okay, so let me now say a bit about what states we're going to consider. So this is the class of states that we're able to work with so far. So we're going to look at states that can be defined by Euclidean path integral, working in the field operator basis. And for convenience, we're picking coordinates where that time slice we're looking at is at t equals 0. So this is how we define the state. Right, so we're going to pick some initial state far in the past, and we're just going to evolve it forward in time with our time evolution operator. And then we're going to project it onto the basis we want, and then we're just going to integrate over all possible initial states at that early time. So I think this is a fairly common prescription, right? If we were working in flat space time, this would basically define the vacuum state for you, right? You would have whatever state you had at some early time. As you evolve it forward with the I epsilon prescription, you would basically damp out eventually, right, all of the excited states, and you would be left with basically the vacuum state when you got to this surface here. And it's fairly well known that you can write that as a Euclidean path integral over the fields in a region of space-time below the time surface t equals 0. Okay. So we could also define a state analogously by starting with some state at a late time, evolving it back.
I'm sorry, in the last term when you write it as a Euclidean path integral, don't you want your field to vanish in the past?
No. You don't care what it is. The I epsilon protection on the back.
But the action won't be finite if it's going to some
immediately minus.
As long as the extra is positive, then it takes care of this. Takes care of this.
Okay. All right. So you could also define a state psi tilde, where you evolve from some random state in the far future back in time to time t equals 0, in the same sort of manner. All right. So we want to compute the expectation value of the log of the reduced density matrix on this time slice t equals 0. So to compute that expectation value, we really need psi and psi tilde to be equivalent. Well, yeah, almost, I think. So I don't know all that much about Schwinger-Keldysh. But so if we just require that psi and psi tilde are equivalent, that places some restriction on the evolution operator. So it was suggested to us recently that we might be able to get rid of this particular restriction by using Schwinger-Keldysh, but we haven't looked into that yet. Yeah. So I think this condition probably isn't too important. And that's why I didn't mention it in the beginning.
If you remove it, Keldysh thing goes from minus infinity up to T you're doing and then back to this.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You're in fact doing that because of this condition.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Okay. All right. So I should say the main reason for looking at states defined in this particular way is that they involve a path integral over the a path integral involving the exponential of negative the action, and we want to eventually get the effective action in the Kalman-Wilczek formula. That's the idea. All right. So now I'm going to show you how we derive the Kalman-Wilczek formula in the course of three slides. Right. So first, let's just remind ourselves what the geometry is. Right. So I'm just going to do this for flat space time because it's simpler, and then I'll tell you to what cases it generalizes to. All right. So we have flat space time. Right. I'm just putting my time slice at tau equals 0, Euclidean time, and the entangling surface is at z equals 0. Right. So let's just go to polar coordinates. So our entangling surface now is at r equals 0, and this time slice is at beta equals 0. Right. And we have this rotational symmetry around the entangling surface. In Lorentzian signature, just so we have the picture in our minds, right? If we continue theta to I times eta, basically, right? We just get flat space in Rindler-like coordinates, and this rotation symmetry becomes a Boost symmetry about the entangling surface. All right. So now let's go back to the reduced density matrix. So we're going to want to basically compute what this reduced density matrix is for the particular class of states that we're looking at. So that's just the definition from before. All right. For this class of states, right, I can write each of these states as Euclidean path integral over the future or the past, right? So I just get a path integral over all space with particular boundary conditions as I go to the time slice from below and from above. Right? And if I'm in polar coordinates, right, I can just, you know, above and below, the time slice sigma is just theta equals 0 and theta equals 2 pi. All right. So let's think about what this is really telling us to do. So I would argue that this is basically telling us to integrate over all fields in space-time with particular boundary conditions above and below the slice sigma. So we have, you know, phi a prime below and phi a above. Okay. So we can think about doing this path integral over all space. We can sort of go do the path integral looking at lots of different surfaces using theta to just enumerate those half planes, right? So if we think of theta as a Euclidean time coordinate, right, we're just doing sort of a path integral around the entangling surface. And then we sort of know what the answer is. Right, we have this rotational symmetry. The thing that takes us from one half plane to the next is just the generator of rotations. Right? So this is really just computing then the time evolution operator in theta, which is just the exponential of negative 2 pi times the generator of rotations. Right? Okay. All right. So we're almost there. Okay. So we need one more little trick.
You just repeated the derivation of the Edinburgh effect.
Okay.
The Edinburgh effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's just first concentrate on this right-hand side. All right. So I think you'll agree that if rho is normalized, so its trace is 1, then this is the entanglement entropy, right? This would be 0 because I have log of 1, and this would be 1. So I just have the entanglement entropy that I want, right? It's easy to convince yourself that this expression is actually invariant under rescalings of rho. Okay. So this really does compute the entanglement entropy that I want. And it's also fairly easy to convince yourself that by taking this particular derivative operator, acting on the log of the trace of rho to this power of 1 minus epsilon, and then taking this limit, gives you the right-hand side. Okay. So now I can compute the entanglement entropy in this form, which is starting to look like the Kallen-Golchak form.
So here you're getting around the replica trick by imagining that you can take a fractional power of rho, for which you don't
True.
Have a general path integral formula, but for this special case.
Yes, for this special case. That's right. Right. Yeah. So that's real. I mean, the rotation symmetry is really, really helping us out there. Right.
It is the replica trick again.
That's right.
It's not exactly the replica trick. In the replica trick, you actually do things by calculating.
And right, and then you analytically continue, and then
as if there is claiming that there's an operator which is the analytic continuation.
Right, he's found the analytic continuation.
Yeah,
he's found it. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that exists.
Rowland.
But you do it on a different geometry. In the replica trick, you in some sense just keep the geometry flat, just lose the copies and the cut surface. Here you just change the geometry.
It was certainly known before the
he hasn't changed the geometry.
Yeah, haven't changed.
Do it now to make the operator work.
Okay, so this doesn't work on a lattice, but you won't be able to cut the wedge like this.
Right.
That's the difference.
But this canonical derivation was certainly known before. It's just you're making a derivation that doesn't refer to the replicas, that's just directly off of this cone. Well, I guess I'm still not sure what exactly is new about this.
So I'd say most of this isn't very new. Yeah. Right. So we haven't. Right. We've found explicitly what this, right, this reduced density matrix is. Right. And because it's so simple, right, we can easily just raise it to a power. Right. Right. When we raise this to a power, right, that's essentially evaluating the density matrix on a space with this conical singularity cut out. Right. Where the deficit is related to epsilon. Right. Just by delta is equal to 2 pi epsilon. And then we just want to trace right over this power of the reduced density matrix. Right? That's the definition of the reduced density matrix to the power. Right? Now we're tracing over all fields. Right? And right, it's we're just working now on a space where we have a conical singularity. Right? So this is just a path integral over that space where we have e to the affect the Euclidean action, but now it's the Euclidean action for a space with this conical singularity, right? And that's just the definition of the effective action.
Something really weird happened here with this conical singularity, because, I mean, I think your derivation up there on the top line is really it's a formal thing. It's not rigorously mathematically true when you're talking about the quantum field theory. And when you interpret in this geometrical language and this conical singularity appears, all of a sudden, anything that couples the curvature is going to have a non-trivial contribution at that conical singularity. Like if you have a non-minimally coupled scalar field, then it's going to contribute to this entropy here. Even though I might have thought that the non-minimally coupled scalar field in flat space-time has to have the same value of trace rho log rho as the minimally coupled scalar field, but we've sort of, because it's divergent, we've sort of regulated it formally in a way that suddenly brings in curvature. Doesn't that seem a little bit strange?
That might be true. I'm not entirely sure. So I'll talk eventually about the non-minimally coupled scalar, and I'll show you how we think about it, and you can ask me again if you think there's something fishy going on. I mean, when, I don't
know. Yeah, but somehow you're sidestepping the whole issue of what the field is or how it's coupled to anything, right? Because at the end of the day, you've integrated it out, and mm-hmm. you've got your W sub E now depends only on the metric.
Right.
So it doesn't really matter what the field was or how you integrated it.
Well, it matters in terms of what coefficients you get in the effective
right,
action.
Sorry. It matters in terms of what coefficients you get. But right. then you're going to tell us that those are all absorbed. As soon
right.
as you know the effective action, it's going to be related to the entanglement entropy one-to-one way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So you never really needed to know even what the original action was, in some sense.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's what you can simply conclude from saying that, you know, this is the way that you compute the entanglement entropy. I mean, I think, you know, looking back on these results, that sort of is maybe the lesson.
W sub E is defined by this procedure, or W sub E has an independent definition?
So W sub E is the effective action on the space with the conical singularity.
Which is, by definition, this pattern.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The I think the step that I think is funny is when the equality is in the middle of the page there, where you go from the trace.
From here to here?
To the even, yeah. Because it seems like the trace formula of e to the minus of the thermal state is essentially something that's true when you delete the point at the center. And just thinking about how this boost Hamiltonian affects the state away from the singularity, whereas the e to the minus effective action is really has a contribution from right at the center.
Okay. So I certainly agree that this operator k is not well defined at the right at the center, right? So as I'm going to do, I'm going to smooth out the conical singularity, right? So if I smooth out the conical singularity, then I think, right, then this operator k is well defined even at the.
Okay, but if you smooth out the conical singularity, is this trace thing still? If it's still, it's changing what's inside of the your definition of the state. Then.
Maybe.
How do you smooth it out?
I'll explain how I smooth it out in a few slides. I won't show you the actual details that are in the paper, but
if you go back to Lorentzian signature, what have you done there?
What have we done? So what exactly?
Can you record take this picture like you did before?
It's a lot harder to think about. I'm not sure I have a very good picture about what it looks like.
Getting back to Aaron's question, mm-hmm. if you simply remove, in the line where you have that functional integral,
yep.
if you sort of imagine removing the tip and not including delta function contributions mm-hmm. from the curvature of the tip,
yep.
you get the wrong answer.
You get the wrong answer. So you. Maybe this answers your question. This effective action, right, if you have an actual conical singularity, right, so this effective action has UV divergences just from your usual bulk UV divergences from integrating out the field. But it can also have UV divergences because you have the singularity on the entangling surface.
You need to keep that.
So what you find is that when you regulate the conical singularity, when you regulate it, you're basically smoothing it out. So those potential UV divergences coming from the conical singularity itself are no longer there. Right, but when you take your regulator off, they would come back. Right, so you do this computation for the smoothed out effective action. And what you find is basically that the only thing that's going to contribute to the entanglement entry are terms that are basically proportional to delta. So it turns out the terms that come from the UV divergences associated with the conical singularity, those are higher order in delta. So they don't end up contributing to the entanglement entropy. I don't know if that answers your question.
Coupling to the curvature still contributes, though. It's just rendered finite.
Yeah.
So, well, it can be itself associated with divergences, the divergences.
What contributes?
If you smooth out the conical singularity, if your effective action has a divergence which has a coefficient with the proportional to, say, the Ricci scalar, that will still. There will still be a contribution coming from the smoothed out curvature.
Yeah.
What you will not get, as he was explaining, is a divergence due to the fact that the curvature is itself infinite.
Right.
As to your question about whether you get the right answer if you delete the conical tip, I think it actually depends on which field you're considering. At least if you use heat kernel methods of regularization, if you consider a minimally coupled scalar, then the contribution to the entanglement entropy comes entirely from loops that go around, Feynman loops that go around the conical singularity. But if you have a non-minimally coupled scalar, or if you have this vector gauge field, there are in addition loops that begin and end on the curvature, on the delta function singularity, and these give a contribution, a divergent contribution as well. That, if you smear out the curvature, as you say, it's still there, but only because you put in curvature instead of really doing it in a different way, like putting in a brick wall. I think if you put in a brick wall around this point, you'll typically get different answers, unless you couple your field to the brick wall in a way that exactly cancels that. So I think it's actually kind of mysterious. I actually agree this gives you good answers for the black hole entropy, but I'm not sure we really fully understand why.
Good answer in the sense that you get the hook, like it's time off to walk in.
Yes, yes.
Well, I mean,
if you get the hook, so why is that a good answer if you're neglecting the gravity?
If you're neglecting, well.
I mean, all the entanglement entropy is coming from the bottom gravitational field. What happens if you're turning them on?
The Beckenstein-Hawking term comes from the classical gravitational action. So even if you have no gravitons, you can still get a term coming from integral.
Well, I'm sure you get a term, but why do you expect it to be equal to the exact?
This is supposed to give you the London correction to the Beckenstein-Hawking. It's all loop correction, but it doesn't include the classical piece. You're not claiming that the entanglement entropy reproduces the leading term, are you?
Yes.
You can get that too.
With a renormalized.
Yeah. With a renormalized. That's right.
It gives divergence, quadratic divergence.
It's timing. The divergence plus the bare.
Right.
It gives you exactly
the classical.
The normalized constant.
Right.
So it sounds a bit, that's what you said in the introduction.
Yeah.
It sounded a bit smaller. But I was just wondering, why do you want to get that anyway? I mean, because there are also gravitational.
Contribution
to the entropy of the black hole.
But that would just change both, right?
Yeah,
it changes the velocity and the renormalization. So,
yeah.
I mean, just like he hasn't specified how many matter fields he has, and that would change the numbers, but like you say, the whole
and
thing
he's
works.
He's never going to. He never actually writes it. The action for the fields are integrated.
Right.
Are you going to use, I mean, I know we keep interrupting, but there's a derivation of the Hawking-Beckenstein entropy, mm-hmm. which looks very much like this, right? Where we get the usual, you know, conical singularity, take little derivatives. And do you use that? Or
no.
Is that sort of just, you never use that?
No.
Oh, I see. Not having read your paper, I assume that was the key point. Hawking-Beckenstein entropy was derived by a formula very similar to this entanglement entropy thing, and that's why it worked. But you're saying that's totally, well.
Yeah, we just strictly compute according to the Kalman-Wilczek formula. What I would say.
But the point, if you insert the classical Einstein-Hilbert action and use that as your effective action in that conical formula, you will get the Beckenstein-Hawking entropy. So it's not a coincidence.
Okay.
It's just a sort of classical limit. But
Hawking and Beckenstein were not trying to compute an entanglement entropy for an arbitrary surface. They were just trying to compute the entropy. And they had to do it. You know, there's this formula where you take beta, d by d beta, minus one of the free energy, and it just looks just like this.
I would say then that calculation, this isn't the language Josh has used, but in my language, I would say that classical term isn't an entanglement entropy at all, because there's no quantum fields to have any entanglement.
Right. But I would interpret that differently, right? The thing you call classical, right, is Right, you probably believe that really that comes out of some quantum theory, right? So it really is, right, no. The Ricci scalar term in Einstein gravity, right, really is the effective action, right, for, right, at the scale that we measure, right, where we measure Einstein gravity to be valid, right? So in that sense, right, it really is the renormalized part, right, of the effective action.
So you claim to have shown that the black hole entropy is entanglement entropy, that that's something that can be derived to all orders in perturbation theory.
I think they've shown that point of view is consistent.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah, I would say this really has to do with the semi-classical renormalization of the entropy and the divergence. I wouldn't say it's there's another stronger hypothesis which says not only are these the renormalization of divergences match, but ultimately if we went all the way down to the Planck scale, we discovered that the black hole entropy really is nothing but entanglement. That's a much stronger hypothesis. It talks about full quantum gravity. I don't think this implies that stronger hypothesis.
But it's consistent.
But it's consistent.
Right. It could have come out inconsistent.
Right, and in fact, I'll get to the literature, right? In the literature, there are claims that this interpretation is not consistent with that very strong interpretation of the black hole entropy being entirely entanglement entropy. And we argue that things that people think are inconsistent in literature are actually not inconsistent. So, I mean, I'll point that out in particular later on, but. So.
We should let it go.
Yeah. Enough private conversations. Okay. Proceed. Take a monopoly of our attention.
Okay, so, right, so that little derivation of the Kalmuchuk formula was just for flat space. So we claim that it generalizes to a class of Euclidean metrics, which you can write down that are of this form. So we have this, right, we have a Killing vector associated with theta, right, that's the rotational symmetry about the entangling surface, and we're just writing the time slice sigma in Gaussian normal coordinates. Right? That's really all there is here. Okay. These metrics have to satisfy some further conditions so that they're not singular, and one of them happens to be, which is really implied by the rotation symmetry, but the entangling surface must have vanishing extrinsic curvature. These other things, this just tells you that it looks like flat space really close to the origin, and then these are just so that the metric is not singular at the origin.
For a space-time like curve, this would not.
I believe that's true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So then the corresponding right class of Lorentzian spacetimes are basically spacetimes that have a bifurcated Killing horizon, right, where the bifurcation surface is the entangling surface.
Did you say curve would not work?
Those have an analytic continuation to Euclidean.
This derivation doesn't apply. It's very substantial.
All right.
Also, this is a Hart-Hopkins state.
Yeah.
Well, the absence of the Hart-Hopkins state has to do with the place region far from the surface. So if you just focus on the region close, I thought there's still a Killing symmetry that looks like a boost near the bifurcation surface.
That would be a further generalization of this calculation. It probably goes through it in that case.
I believe it does work in curve. Except for the absence of the Hart-Hopkins state. I would believe it would work for curve in a sufficiently small box.
Probably, but his argument to give right now is not that much.
Okay.
Maybe need a tiny tweak.
Mm-hmm. All right. Right. So the Kalmuchuk formula, right, tells you to put this conical singularity in. Right. So to make that well defined, we should really regulate the conical singularity. So, right, we started off with this class of smooth Euclidean metrics. Right, we can put a conical singularity in quite simply. Right, we're just going to basically rescale the theta coordinate, right, by introducing this factor of 1 minus epsilon, right, related to the deficit as usual. Okay. So in this metric, as I said before, right, now the Euclidean effective action can have UV divergences that are associated with the entangling surface itself. So now we want to regulate that metric. And this is how we do it. So we take the function alpha or alpha bar, and we replace it by this function alpha tilde, which is just alpha times a factor that looks like this. Right? So we have introduced some new function. It's a function of the coordinate r and a length scale l, which is acting as the regulator. Right, so the basic way to think about this is that this function is just sort of rounding off the tip of the cone. So in the paper, we use a particular function, and in particular, Solodukin and Fersay have used some other regulator a while ago. You can probably use a whole variety of different types of things. All right. So now this metric is smooth again, right? So there are not going to be any UV divergences coming from the conical singularity itself. But of course, you would recover those when you take L to 0. All right, so the reason we can't treat gravitons is that in order for the graviton field to be well-defined, you would need this metric to be a solution to the field equations. Right, so then you have to ask, well, if I put in this regulator, right, what stress energy tensor does that require me to have in order that the field equations are satisfied? As far as we can tell, you have to introduce extra massless degrees of freedom in order to put in the right type of stress tensor. Right? So that means you're not just modifying your theory in the UV with the scale L, but you're also introducing an IR modification of your theory, which is not what you want to do. So we haven't figured out how to introduce a regulator of the conical singularity that doesn't have this issue.
So if you don't include fluctuating gravitons, how do you get the right answer for your normalization of Newton's constant? Those certainly contribute, right? They're among the fields that can fluctuate.
Right. So we're just saying, right, you know, when I'm computing my effective action, right, I specify some fields that I'm going to integrate out.
Right.
I'm just saying that those fields that I'm integrating out, none of them are quantum fluctuations of gravity, right? So if they were there, they would contribute to the renormalization of Newton's constant. But if they're not, then they...
The claim is that when he renormalizes, it renormalizes Newton's constant and everything else in such a way that it's consistent with the entanglement entropy being equal to the vectors being
constant.
And he can't do that calculation with gravity.
Okay.
But
right.
If he could,
it would still work.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that it wouldn't work. It's just that rigorously, I don't know how to do that.
All right.
Okay. All right. Okay, so now we can just do the calculation. Right. So here's our, right, the first number of terms and a derivative expansion of the effective action. And the tilde means that we've regulated this singularity. Right. So I'm just going to write that in a shorthand, right? Just as a sum over curvature invariance F tilde. Right. So the Kalin-Wilczek formula tells us that we can compute the entanglement entropy by taking this operator acting on this effective action. And everything is regulated, so we have to add this limit as we take the regulator of the conical singularity off. So if we first take the derivative and look and evaluate this limit, what you find is that only the order epsilon to the 1 pieces in any of these UV divergent invariants, only the epsilon to the 1 pieces contribute. And then if you take the regulator off, you can do the integrals over the coordinates that are basically transverse to the entangling surface. And this is the answer you get for the entanglement entropy. Right? So you have this negative 2 pi, an integral over the entangling surface, and then you just have a sum over all UV divergent terms, right? The coefficient of the term in the effective action to whatever order you're interested in computing, right? The divergence, and then this geometrical invariant. And in our paper, we tell you how to explicitly compute this geometrical invariant for whatever UV divergence term F you're interested in. All right. OK, so let's just look at an example, which I showed you briefly before. Right. So the leading UV divergence term in the entanglement entropy, right, comes from the Einstein-Hilbert term in the effective action. Okay. So if we use our algorithm to compute the entanglement entropy via the Kalin-Wilczek formula, the curvature invariant I1 for the Ricci scalar is just equal to 2. So I get an integral over the entangling surface giving me the area, and I just get this particular contribution. All right. So now I can add a counter term. This is the standard form to my effective action. And that will give rise to a new piece in the entanglement entropy. Right now I'm computing the renormalized entanglement entropy. And these two things combine very nicely because the renormalized Planck mass is defined in this particular way. Right? So the leading contribution to the entanglement entropy is precisely given by the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, right, with all the factors of two working out and so forth.
And in principle, that could have failed at this point, or not.
I suppose so.
I mean, at some point you calculate the number 2.
Right? Yeah, right.
That it could have been 3.
Then it wouldn't have worked. That's right. Yep. Okay, so we can also look at subleading UV divergent terms. So let's just look at the four derivative terms in the gravitational effective action, right? We have the Ricci scalar squared, the Riemann tensor squared, that one, and the Ricci tensor squared. Oh, I forgot the divergence. Sorry. Okay, so we can use the algorithm to compute the entanglement entropy via the Kalin-Wilczek formula, and we get some results, which check out with some previous calculations in the literature. I think the most interesting to note about these is that these contributions explicitly depend on the quantum state that we're computing in. So the way to see that is as follows, right? So these results depend on, right, the functions in the metric alpha and gamma, right? In particular, these derivatives with respect to R of those functions. So it's not hard to convince yourself that these derivatives of those functions cannot be written in terms of geometric invariants that are intrinsic to the time slice sigma itself. But the entanglement entropy was defined with this time slice, this entangling surface on the time slice, and the state, right? So sigma and omega are intrinsic to sigma, right? But the state, right, we got by doing this path integral over all space-time. So that's the only thing probing space-time away from the slice, right? So that's the only thing that can give rise to this dependence in the entanglement entropy. Yep?
I'm not sure I agree.
Okay.
Or perhaps this comes down to the question of what we mean by state. How do you know that these other states, you can only look at the Hartle-Hawking states here.
That's true.
So what we're doing is we're really comparing the Hartle-Hawking state on two different geometries, which have the same intrinsic geometry to sigma. And you're saying that because the Hartle-Hawking states for the two, because the sigmas are the same, you could sort of compare both states on the same sigma slice and say that their subleading divergences of the entropy are different. But have you shown that these states are regular, are properly regular when considered in the other geometry? That is it really true that in quantum field theory and fair space-time, the states only care about the geometry at one instant of time? If I glued together a geometry with a slice where, say, the first derivative of the metric or the second derivative or something changed discontinuously, I would worry that it's sort of too abrupt of a change for the quantum field, so I'd end up getting a state that's sort of infinitely different. Mm-hmm. So how do you know that's not what's happening here?
But your point is that, right, to really make sense of whether or not this depends on the state, right? We have to do a comparison, essentially, is what you're saying. So, So you want, okay, so you want everything to be the same, sigma and omega, but just have a different state defined on.
That's what I thought you were doing, that you had a different space-time geometry sliced by the same geometry of sigma. Is that right?
I think my argument was slightly different, but maybe your point is actually the way I should try to understand it. Right? So I was just saying, right, these are defined, if I pick out a particular member of my class, right, that means I pick a particular alpha and gamma.
Yeah, right? So that's the choice of geometry.
Right. Okay. So what I was saying is that if I take these particular invariants of that geometry, right, I can't write those in terms of the information that I just have on the time slice.
Right, so I agree with that.
Okay.
What I'm worried is that if you change that information, you're actually going to an entirely different Hilbert space of states, that you aren't making a finite change to your quantum state.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think we should continue this later.
Yeah, probably so. Especially since we've basically been the full hour. How much more material do you have here?
I think 3 slides, maybe?
We did object a lot, so we could sort of perhaps consider your Q&A to already have happened. But we definitely can't go any more than...
I hope. There was this earlier work back in January on Bianchi, who showed change in the entanglement entropy with the state. The difference is that's in the finite part, or how's that related?
I'm pretty sure that's in the finite part.
Okay, so the new thing here is getting it in the infinite part.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so. All right, so let me try to tell you how this fits in with the literature, right? So we had the Susskind-Oglom conjecture about just the area term in 1994. And then there have been a whole lot of papers that basically just tried to check whether or not the Susskind-Oglom conjecture was true. As far as I know, these are pretty much all one-loop calculations for a whole variety of different fields. And some people say that it works in some of these cases and doesn't work in others, the Susskind-Oglom conjecture. There are also some people looked at extending the Susskind-Oglom conjecture in particular to the 4 derivative UV divergent terms. So Fursave and Soloducan looked at that for the minimally coupled scalar at one loop, and Zanardi and others looked at that for the spin 1 at one loop. And as far as I know, they claim that Susskind-Oglom in this extended sense worked out in those cases. All right. So our result, right, is basically a demonstration of the Susskind-Oglom conjecture for all leading and subleading UV divergent terms, for all spins, minimally or non-coupled, except maybe spin 2, and to all orders in perturbation theory. That's what we're claiming. All right. So if you're familiar with the literature, and as has come out earlier, right, one of the real sticking points is this issue of non-minimal coupling. Right? So let's look at what the literature says about the non-minimally coupled spin 0 field. Right? So right, we just have this action in Lorentzian signature that looks like that with our non-minimal coupling C. Right? So some people have done this calculation at one loop. Right, and they computed the effective action. This is the UV divergent part. You get some non-universal constant, but then you get this factor 1/6 minus the coupling C. And then this is the standard counter term that you would add to renormalize the Newton constant, for instance. Okay, so people have also calculated the entanglement entropy at one loop. Coming from the Einstein-Hilbert term when you have a scalar field of this sort. And what they find is that this is the UV divergent part. You get the same universal constant C depending on what scheme you're using. Over 1/4, you get this factor again in the area. If you add the counter term, you would get this. And we would say there's nothing wrong, right? Because the renormalized Planck mass is defined precisely in this way, right? So you just absorb anything about this curvature coupling into the definition of the renormalized Planck mass. So the things that people worried about, or seem to worry about, are there two things, right? First of all, if C is big enough, it looks like this goes negative, right? Well, it does go negative. But we would say that this UV divergent piece alone is not physical, right? What's physical is the renormalized thing. So when you renormalize it, well, you get something that's finite and positive, and it just is the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. The other thing that people worried about was that this C appears at all, right? Right? If you're in flat space time, there's no curvature to couple to, so you wouldn't expect this to appear. But even in that, if you took that limit, you would still get a C appearing in the entanglement entropy. But again, right, the interpretation is that this piece alone is not physical, right? What's physical is the renormalized thing. And when you renormalize, any dependence on the C just goes away, right? Because it's absorbed into your definition of the renormalized constant.
What is the definition of the renormalized entropy?
What is the definition that we're using? The definition that we're using is, so I take this particular Lagrangian, and on some background spacetime G, and I integrate out these fields, say at one, in this case at one loop, and I look at the coefficient of the Ricci scalar in the effective action. That's what I mean.
You haven't discovered anything different in this case than any of these previous people that were worried about it. It's just you're not worried about it.
Well, we think right.
More solid digestion.
Right, but they were all worrying about this UV divergent piece, which by itself is not physical, right? What's physical is the renormalized quantity. So we just think they interpret things. I mean, yeah, I'm just saying I'm basically saying they did not interpret things correctly. That's true.
Well, it turned out they go all the way up to the Planck scale, and the total integrated amount of entropy is negative. Wouldn't that be a problem?
Perhaps. But I don't.
Again, there's a numerical thing that had to work out, right?
There is a numerical thing that had to work out, right? You had to get, this 1/4 and these C's had to, And in these calculations, if you go back and look at the papers, it does work out.
I don't actually see that. Whatever it is there adds on that you just call the renormalized.
No, because he's got two formulas. Yeah. He's got W plus W counter term, and he's got the entropy. And the coefficients are the same. The complete coefficient is the same in both cases. It can be called renormalized entropy. And those two terms in the two cases could have had different numerical coefficients, which I guess some people claimed in the past in some cases.
Maybe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the last thing I wanted to mention was just a comparison to the Wald entropy. So Wald showed that if I have a Lagrangian, an arbitrary Lagrangian as some function of the Riemann tensor and its derivatives, right, I can define an entropy by this particular formula. It's applicable when the equations of motion for this Lagrangian hold, and when I have a space-time with a bifurcate Killing horizon that's asymptotically flat, which is like the situation we've been considering. And the important thing to note is that this is really sort of the classical thermodynamic or mechanical entropy in the sense that you can prove a classical first law for this entropy when you're working in a theory defined by that Lagrangian. Okay. So we can compare our results for the renormalized entanglement entropy for some effective action to what you would compute from the Wald entropy for that effective action. And that would maybe tell you whether or not this entanglement entropy has some kind of thermodynamic interpretation. All right. So it's known that if your Lagrangian is just a function of the Riemann tensor and not derivatives of it, then you find agreement between the renormalized entanglement entropy and the Wald entropy. So we can look at terms that involve derivatives of the Riemann tensor. So we just decided to look at this one particular term, the covariant derivative of the Riemann tensor squared. Right. And we're just going to compute in a metric that's slightly simplified. We're just going to take this as the transverse space is going to be a sphere. All right. So what we find is that the Wald entropy is equal to the renormalized entropy, but there's this extra term here. Okay. That depends on. Total derivative. Not sure, actually. Maybe it is.
There's a box.
Yeah.
Why couldn't we just say, if it's total derivative, why can't we just drop it and declare victory?
I don't know why we hadn't thought of that.
Which direction is it acting? You go over the horizon.
So yeah, this is the D'Alembertian basically associated with this. Maybe it is a total derivative. Yeah, I think so. Okay. So I was going to say that, well, maybe that just clears things up. Right? I mean, you might still get a constant, though, right?
No.
Yeah, not for a top line. That's right. Okay. Yeah, so we should look at a different term and see what happens. Sorry about
that. Don't you think it's just going to have to be equal? Two different entropies.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, there is the question of if we calculate in different states, right? We can only calculate in sort of particular class of states. But could there be some difference?
Yeah, didn't you tell us that these terms are state dependent? These higher order terms?
That's right.
So,
yeah, so
the entropy doesn't require a choice of state.
Well, they're state dependent in the sense that. Right. The state is defined via path integral over the space-time, right? So the dependence on the space-time functions, right, gets encoded in the state. Right. The so in our metric we have functions like alpha, right? When I compute the state on that particular geometry, right, the state is going to in some sense involve right these metric functions. Right. And right. If, in particular, it involves the metric functions in some way that I can't write as intrinsic to the, well, I guess that's, so that, I mean, that's, yeah. So the state is going to involve these metric functions. So in that sense, the fact that these show up in the higher UV divergent terms are an indication that the state, that they're state dependent, is what I would say. All right. Okay, so
we've been asking the question, right,
how does one compute the entanglement entropy associated with some entangling surface in a quantum field theory on a fixed background space-time? Right, we claim that, at least for a certain class of quantum states, the Kalman-Wilczek formula does give us a geometric definition of this entanglement entropy for a pretty much arbitrary quantum field theory. Moreover, right, the UV divergent terms in the entanglement entropy arise from the UV divergent terms in the gravitational effective action in the one-to-one correspondence.
And therefore,
the entanglement entropy is rendered UV finite by precisely the counter terms that render the gravitational effective action UV finite to all orders in perturbation theory. Right. So there are clearly still some open questions. Right? So we've only been able to give this geometric definition of entanglement entropy up to some certain caveats, right? And there were a bunch of caveats. It's certainly true. So, right, we might like to figure out how to get beyond these. Right. There's also the question of, while we expect it's probably the case that the Wald and entanglement entropies give the same thing, we haven't been able to show that in general. Right. Everyone is interested in this question, right? Is the black hole entropy really just entanglement entropy? And I would say that, as it came out before, right, our results at least would suggest that it is consistent, as a consistent possibility that the entangled entropy is the black hole entropy. And then, of course, right, we'd want to know, is the entanglement entropy well-defined in a quantum theory of gravity? I don't know. All right, so I think that's it.
So the leading UV divergent term in the gravitational effective action isn't the Einstein term, it's the quantum
right.
term. Is it clear that doesn't contribute to
yeah. the entanglement entropy? It's quite clear that it doesn't contribute.
Because of your formula for how you compute those I's, or is it there's just a relative?
Yeah.
Epsilon squared or something?
No. That just enters with a square root of G and then a constant, right? So if you're acting, you have this operator d by d epsilon plus 1 actuating on the square root of G. And in the limit as epsilon goes to 0,
this is very confused. So if you take the Kallen-Wilczek formula, that's all clear. But I'm confused about what it means to have derived the Kallen-Wilczek formula without yet having introduced a regulator. Uh-huh. I mean, the entanglement entropy is divergent.
Well, okay.
Both sides of that equation are divergent.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do a formal regulation and then say they're equal, and then you regulate UV divergent, and then you regulate the right-hand side, are you telling me that there is a separate independent definition of a regulator on the left-hand side, which formula still works, or are you telling me that you can use the formula to define a UV regulator of the left-hand side where the formula still works, which of course is clearly true, but
right.
less contentful than the formula?
Yeah.
And if that's what you're telling me, then I certainly believe you, but it raises questions about
mm-hmm.
if you calculate the entanglement entropy at high energies, is it negative, does it do funny things,
mm-hmm.
what does it look like?
Yeah.
And what's the content of that statement?
Mm-hmm. I certainly understand your objection.
It might be a question, not an objection.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. I think your criticism might be right. I'm not sure that we're. I hadn't quite thought about it in that way.
What do you mean by original regularization of the entanglement? There may be a good definition, but it's not immediately obvious to me. It would be independent to say using this formula.
Maybe we should continue this prior.
I guess. We absolutely should. Thank you very much.